Thank you very much, and welcome to the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the San Diego Metropolitan Transit District. And clerk, please call the roll.
Alvarez? Bragg?
Here.
Cole?
Here.
Cunningham? Jones? Kate?
Here.
Mathis?
Here.
McClellan?
Here.
McWhorter?
Here.
Minto?
Here.
Rios?
Here.
Roberts?
Here.
Salas?
Here.
Roy Woody?
Here.
Saf?
All right, the first item of business will be the approval of minutes from November 10th. And unless there's a comment, a move by Minto, a second by McWhorter. And so without further discussion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We now come to public comments. And the first two speakers who have asked to speak are Richard Lujan and Angelina Lujan. And I understand, it's Mrs. Lujan, you wish to cede the time to your husband, is that correct? And I have to tell you that I can allow one of you to speak, but we don't cede time for public comments. So you wish to speak, sir?
Yes.
Okay, can we come forward to the microphone, please? Somebody will help you.
What's the topic, bus stops?
Good morning.
Yeah.
Want to thank you all for giving this opportunity to speak. And I wanted to see if you guys remember me from 2 months ago when I left some pictures. I hope you guys got a chance to review the pictures I left. I didn't know if you guys got them, received them, but I'm coming down here regarding the bus stops and issues in the Mita Village. I see that you guys did a beautification there at Euclid, and I think that was uncalled for. I know there's probably money allocated just for that issue. But to me, I think it was a waste of money because we don't even have bus benches and bus stops that are they're handicapped accessible in the Mita. And you guys went and did that beautification there at Euclid. I know you did Iris. I know there's probably money was funded for that, but you guys should have did something to defer that money to put it into better use than bringing it up to a nicer bus stop or whatever you guys want to call it. But to me, I think it's a waste of money. And I hope you guys can take the opportunity to take a tour out to La Mita Village. I know Myrtle Cole only goes out there for photo ops, so I don't know if you guys even know where the Mita Village is, but it's Southeast San Diego. And I want you guys to see what we go through, what we have to put up with every day. You know, you guys don't know, my bus stops look like a dump, like a landfill to the dump. Okay, and we're not second-class citizens, so we shouldn't have to put up with that. So you guys should all be ashamed of yourselves because you guys don't give a hoot about our district. Okay, so I would like all of you to get out there and make a trip out to the 4th District and see Greater Skyline Hills in La Mita Village. I'm not talking in Canto, I'm talking La Mita Village and Greater Skyline Hills bus stops that we have to put up with and what I have to go through to get on and off the bus. So that's it. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I have Mike Aguirre down as the next speaker. Is he here? Okay, we'll go on to the following speaker, Chris Olson. Mr. Olson.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Mathis and board members. My name is Chris Olson. I'm a volunteer citizen planner from Pacific Beach. I'm also co-founder of Beautiful PB, which is a 100% volunteer nonprofit organization. And we're coordinators of the Pacific Beach Eco District. I was here last month and presented you all with a petition to approve our application to relocate our farmers market onto our Main Street Garnet for 5 hours on a Tuesday on a two-block section, and there's no bus stops on that section. I want to give you an update what's happened since then. I received a letter of support from council member and board member Lori Zapp. Thank you for that. Signatures continue to gather online for the petition. There was a front page article on our newspaper that, well, I didn't come up with this headline, but it says, Farmers Market Wants to Grow, MTS Says No. It was actually a very good article and talked a lot about the reasons why the farmers market would be good for our community. And now I want to give you an update on what I've heard from MTS. Yes, the silence has been very frustrating. I haven't received an email, a phone call, a letter, any response at all. I know nothing about what the status is. The only MTS person I've talked to is the bus driver on the 27 route. And when I was on the bus the other day, I asked her, what would you do if we had this farmer's market here on this two-block section of Garnett? And she said, well, there's no stops there, so I just go over one block, go down Hornblend, go two blocks, turn left, come back on my route, and go on. So it's a shame I have to bring it here to the board and waste your time when a bus driver has a very simple solution. But anyway, that's my update, and we'll see you again next month. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Olson. The next speaker is Gretchen Newsom.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. It's a pleasure to be here today. I wish it was under better circumstances. But Gretchen Newsom, on behalf of IBEW Local 569 and our 3,300 electrical workers and power professionals and working families of San Diego and Imperial Counties, I'm here today to alert you to electrical hazards and public safety concerns that our staff have uncovered related to the installation of new MTS bus shelters. In 1999, as many of you will recall, Brian Williams died from electrocution while sitting in a lit MTS bus shelter at 6th Avenue and Market, and the MTS board was outraged and sought to make sure that this never happened again. Unfortunately, this could very well happen again as we have uncovered evidence that new MTS bus shelters are being installed by workers that are not California State certified electricians. It appears MTS awarded a contract to Clear Channel for the installation of new electrified bus shelters, whereby MTS would not have to pay for these public facilities, but Clear Channel would pay for the installation and in return receive advertising rights to the bus shelters. This is an example of a public-private partnership that puts our communities at risk. When we reached out to MTS staff to alert you to our findings of faulty craftsmanship, which we have photographic evidence of, live wires, et cetera, there are many other hazardous issues related to this, IBEW 569 staff were told to take up this matter with your contract awardee, Clear Channel, who then demurred from acknowledging these hazards and ensuring that this electrical work would be done by skilled, trained, and certified electricians. MTS needs to take on oversight and accountability for its bus shelters, rather than shirking these duties and our public safety for the sake of saving a buck and putting lives at risk. We want the public protected for this electric and for this electrical work to be done by trained and certified professionals. So I submit to you today some of the evidence that we have compiled, and we desire to discuss this matter further with staff and call upon the board to immediately look into this matter and ensure that these electrified bus shelters are installed by California State certified electricians. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And of course, we'll look into that. That's the last of our public speakers on public comment. So we'll go on now to the consent agenda.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Yes.
When would it be appropriate? Those items were not on the agenda, so we will not discuss them. When would it be appropriate for us to request a written response from staff on these three issues? We heard an ADA compliance issue, electrical wire exposure issue. All could be liabilities to MTS. And the third was a response on from the individual from PB.
You want to respond?
Can I request that now? No, I don't need a response now. I would like to see something in writing.
No, and that's fine, and we will certainly comply
with
that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I believe we provided a response to all the board members about the Pacific Beach issue. We can reissue that, though.
But yeah, we'll comply with that request, Mr. Alvarez. All right, the consent agenda is items 6 through 14. Does anyone wish to pull any of the items for discussion? If not, I'll take a motion to that effect. And from Mr. McWhirter, Is there a second from Ms. Bragg? No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We will now adjourn into closed session, and we'll be back to resume the meeting as soon as we're finished. I'm sorry. Yes, there is once. I'm reminded that there is a speaker who wants to speak on an item in closed session. Thank you for the reminder. So I'll ask that speaker to come forward now. Hang on just a minute until I find your slip. Yes, Joshua Stoltz, please come forward and we'll hear from you, sir.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Joshua Stoltz, Vice President of PTA. I would just like to say that I hope all the board members involve themselves in the contract negotiations that PTEA and SDTI are involved in. We have been working under the same contract with no raise for almost 3 years. I have seen senior mechanics move on because of the lack of movement, and we strongly believe coming to an agreement benefits both sides equally. The more experience we lose hurts the company's ability to keep up with the workload, and the lack of a competitive compensation and benefit package makes hiring and keeping qualified employees extremely difficult, as I have seen countless guys get hired after me and leave just because of the fact that there is no contract that that is close to being agreed upon in their eyes. And I hope you guys take some time to look into what we are asking for, and I thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, we'll now go into closed session, and we'll be back. Thank you. Well, we're back in open session, and if everybody come to order, we'll, our counsel will report out.
On item number 24A, conference with labor negotiators, the board received a report from staff. On item number 24B, conference with legal counsel, existing litigation, the board received a report and gave instructions to staff.
Thank you. We'll move on now to item number 30, a fair collection update and white paper. And Sharon Cooney will give the report.
Good morning. So we're here today to cover a number of issues regarding our fair collection system. The challenge that we're facing is that our current fair collection system is out of date. It was purchased in 2003. It's doing really well in that the customers appreciate it. It's very high, in the high 90 percentile customer appreciation. But the hardware is at its end of useful life. We have outdated software that needs to be upgraded. The available upgrades were not performed throughout its life, and so it's very far behind what is up to date today. It requires a great deal of maintenance and troubleshooting on behalf of our team, and small changes to the software really cost a great deal and take a lot of time. There's a platform that we use called WebTix that was created in association with this software that needs to be updated in order to include added security measures. And what we're seeing is a real, as it is throughout the marketplace, we're seeing a real uptick in fraudulent use of credit cards in the past several years. And this is across the board with all merchants. One of the things that has been a topic of conversation here at the board has been what's referred to as PCI compliance, payment card industry data security standards. These were introduced somewhere around 2004, 2005, after we purchased the software. And they're really a set of security controls around cardholder data and ways to reduce credit card fraud. Compliance provides sort of the framework for the security. It's not enforced by any legal regulations. It affects banking fees if you are not in compliance, and that is something that, since we're not in compliance currently, that is a problem for us. We pay a lot more in banking fees. Being in compliance, however, does not guarantee system security, as a number of PCI compliant systems are hacked repeatedly throughout the year. So there are, under PCI compliance, you'll get 12 different requirements which identify areas of responsibility for how we handle the data and for the payment information security. So one of the things that's clear about our current Cubic system that we're using for our next fair collection system is that without significant upgrades, we cannot reach PCI compliance. So what are our immediate options? We can upgrade the current Cubic system to the latest version of NextFair. That's a, you know, something that's already out in the marketplace and it's being used in other agencies that have the Cubic software. Another way to deal with this, however, would be to actually procure a next generation fare collection system, basically replacing this software with a software that has additional features that are kind of more modern and allow for additional features for the customer. So the approach we've been taking here at MTS is that there's a significant cost to upgrade the existing system, so why not explore our options before we make that investment? Meanwhile, we've been continuing to implement some of the security controls within the PCI compliance framework. And then we really want to see upgrades to the existing system or this entirely new system, whichever we choose, to be implemented as quickly as possible. So that's the approach we've been taking. So today I'm going to present to you a number of things. First, we're going to talk about how we've been planning for modernization. We're going to talk about a couple of Cubic proposals for the existing fare collection system. There's a white paper in your packet that we had commissioned, and we're going to go through that with you. We're going to talk about next steps and what our recommendation would be for that. And then finally, we're going to give you an update on our PCI compliance efforts as well as stored value. So MTS staff launched the process we began for modernization in 2014 when we took over the fare collection system from Sandag. This is a multidisciplinary, all divisions involved type of approach because it really, fare collection has its hands in almost every aspect of our business. We've identified broad fare system goals, which we included in the packet as well. And we created a fare collection working group that is really hands-on, people who are working in the fare collection system here at MTS across all divisions. We began the fare study with Sandag and NCTD as well. This was an effort that Sandag is leading this year, and that is something that is intended to really simplify the fares that we offer in the system. And this is something that almost every agency we've talked to says you have got to simplify your fares before you go out and procure a new fare collection system. And then finally, we did ask Cubic to offer us a rough order of magnitude proposals for both just if we wanted to upgrade to the latest version of our fare collection system, and then to go further, what could we do with Cubic to get some enhancements and a more modern fare collection system. So that's what I'm going to begin with, is the Cubic proposals we received. So option A was just the simplest, which is an upgrade to the latest version of their software, NextFair, as well as to replace the platform for credit cards, which is the WebTix platform. It could be hosted here at MTS on our servers, or it could be hosted in the cloud. There are annual maintenance and operations fees associated with that if Cubic takes care of that for us. The only hardware upgrades included in the proposal are those needed to really integrate the new software with the hardware we have, as well as for PCI compliance. And then the 10-year cost estimate of this proposal was $20 million. But we have costs associated with our current version, you know, sort of our licensing fees and the maintenance fees, et cetera. So really the net cost would be another $12 million. This, I want to let you know that this gets nothing new for the customer. So the pros of this is it would provide us better security, and it gives us a path to get to PCI compliance. We'd associated with that reduce our banking fees, and we could probably rebid our merchant services, getting us a better deal with them. This also would provide us with greater reliability. The older version has a lot of kinks in it, and over the years it's kind of morphed a little bit, and we really have a hard time maintaining the system. So the cons would be, you really get nothing more for your money for the customer, so it would not look anything different than what they're getting today, the functionalities. And then the pricing doesn't include hardware, which is really the most expensive part of this system. So the option B would be to upgrade to the latest version of the NextFair software, plus adding on a new type of functionality called Next Account. It's an industry, the industry is moving toward an account-based system. Today we have a card-based system where all of the data is held on the card, the Compass card in your pocket, as well as on all the on the hardware, the ticket vending machines, the validators, et cetera. And that makes it very difficult in a lot of ways, and I'll get into that account-based type of system later on, but I do want to let you know that if we did go with option B for Cubic, we would get all these functionalities that would be new for the customer that we could roll out, like being able to use your bank card to buy your fares, accepting Apple Pay, et cetera. It also would allow us to do certain things with the fare policies as well. So we could do things like, oh, you pay as you go, so you just kind of tap on when instead of having cash, and fare capping, which would mean that, you know, as often as you tap in a day, it'll give you the best fare. So you take three trips, oh, the best fare is actually a day pass, and it would, you know, basically stop you from paying more than what's on a day pass. So the 10-year cost estimate for this proposal was $25 million, but again, the incremental cost is $17 million net. We would have to have a lot of contract discussions to kind of talk about the various features, and again, this does not include the hardware costs associated with replacing PSIDs, which are our validators, or ticket vending machines. The pros of this, you get a lot of advantages of both PCI compliance, security controls. You get an easier transition because it would be going from one the same vendor and the same type of software. And then the customers themselves could continue to use their Compass cards, and they wouldn't feel like it's a big change for them. It would be a lower cost, likely a lower cost than if we actually went out for an RFP and got all new next generation proposals. And it leverages the user familiarity with the system. The cons of this, however, is that it is still relatively untested. A couple other agencies have started using it. One other agency here in the United States has started using it in Chicago. And then there's a couple other agencies who have actually purchased this but have not rolled it out yet. It does still maintain the proprietary nature of the Cubic system, but that is actually something that we would be allowed to negotiate through the contract process. So that is one path that we're looking at, is the Cubic system, but we're also looking at all the other options that are out there for us, and that's really the basis of the white paper that is in your packet. In the summer of 2016, we hired CH2M to help develop really what is it we want from, what functionalities we want from a regional system. And Alan Cheng is here from CH2M. He's the consultant on the project, and I would like to have him say a couple words to you about sort of the process we're going through.
Sure. Thank you, Sharon. Good morning. As Sharon said, I'm the CH2M fare collection representative for Southern California. And just as a little bit of a background, we've worked on, you know, most major fare collection projects in Southern California, in addition to projects around the country. We're currently going through a similar process for New York City Transit, upgrading to the next version of the MetroCard, in addition to projects in Portland, Seattle, Honolulu, and other places around the country. So the issues that Sharon mentioned earlier certainly are not unique to the San Diego region. But the ways to kind of emerge and solve those issues can be different depending on the region. So what you have in front of you in the white paper is our best recommendation to move forward and basically do a little more due diligence in the types of features and the best ways to implement those features in the region. And as part of the white paper, you'll see a range of costs. And those range of costs reflect different functionality for different options moving forward. So Sharon will speak to it, but one of the things we did at the beginning of this process was hold a peer workshop, and some of the best practices from all of the peers around the country going through this similar process are reflected in the white paper. So in summary, the white paper does really reflect best practices from our experience in addition to the peers listed there. Thank you.
So I will say that the workshop was an excellent experience for all of our staff. The people who attended were the top in their field. You know, they're the ones that are implementing in their own cities. So we were really appreciative of their agency giving them to us for 3 days where we could just do a real deep dive. White paper is one of the things that that we developed for you, really, to help you make decisions going forward with regard to our fare collection system. Some of the recommendations from the workshop, we really need to spend sufficient time upfront to determine what we want and the types of vendors, et cetera, that are available to us. And that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years. They all agreed that we need to develop a concept of operations. How do we want this to function? And then what types of things do we need in that functionality as well? And that it's a living document. We're not going to just sit on it for now. It'll go on as we implement. Simplifying your fare structure. Vendors are system integrators and equipment engineers. And they don't really know a lot about the financials or the customer service side of things. So you really want to, you as an agency, need to focus on that and look at what different types of products might be out there that could assist you in kind of doing the back office type transactions, as well as the customer relationship side of things. And then contract negotiation is critical. You can't just simply say, oh, we're just buying this, you know, off the shelf, so here we go. You really have to get into the contract and tell, you know, the vendor that you're going with, this is what I want and how much is it going to really cost me? And then every one of them agreed, don't do this. Don't go to another vendor just because you think they're going to be so great. You know, the grass is never greener on the other side of the fence. So just know that every fare collection system that is launched has their own implementation concerns, their own functionality concerns, and that should not drive you to decide to go with a different vendor. So the ideal system components, I touched on this idea of an account-based system. This would require real-time communications. So what this would allow us to do, though, is basically hold all of the data in the back office. And this would allow us to open up things to new types of ways to purchase your fares. So, for instance, we could go with like a gift card type of scenario where we could get gift cards hanging in every, you know, 7-Eleven or CVS type of thing. It would allow us to do Apple Pay for purchases. It would allow us to have direct billing to people's, you know, bank account, rather than them having to come forward and give us a credit card, et cetera. So it does provide a lot of flexibility. It would also reduce the need to maintain this proprietary reload infrastructure. So one of the hard things is then whenever we push out a new fare table or an upgrade to the system or whatever, you actually have to have it touch every piece of hardware. So it has to get to every ticket vending machine, every validator, every fare box. And that sometimes can cause glitches. And so that's a very unwieldy thing, and it takes a lot of time. As I mentioned, it allows a lot more vending opportunities. Dallas, for instance, they're going with an account-based system, and they actually have over 1,300 retailers who offer fare product, which is amazing when you consider that we've got the, you know, 60-plus Albertsons, Vons stores that sell it for us today, and the transit store. So this would allow us to really open up the market to a lot of different places where the consumer can go to. Another thing that account-based will allow you to do is integrate it better with other technologies. So maybe we want to go to integration with the parking meters. Maybe we want to integrate it with other transit agencies like Metrolink or LA Metro. So that really is one of the things account-based allows you to do. Another thing we want is open architecture. Again, the Cubic system we have today was purchased as a proprietary option, and it really didn't allow us to sort of add in things easily. We had to kind of negotiate with Cubic, and they have been open to allowing us to do that. But what we really need is like kind of like plugs to plug things in. As new technologies come out, new functionalities we want come to the forefront, we want to be able to be nimble with it and do that ourselves. For instance, a great savings for us would be to use a less expensive ticket vending machine. Right now, we have to use the one that is sort of proprietary and we use today. Also, we need better back office hosting and data reporting. This could be through the system integrator, or we could maybe get a third party. And a lot of the agencies that we talked to went in that direction. And then finally, the enhanced security features that we've already discussed. The low and high estimates that we, our consultant have come up with in the white paper is between 25 and 55 million. And a lot of that has to do with what kind of hardware you're purchasing. They include ticket vending machines and new validators, but it does not include new fare boxes because we felt that that was not something that we needed right off the bat. Just for comparison, Portland paid $36 million and Dallas paid $31 million. Dallas, of course, though, did not buy ticket vending machines under that. We do have funding available for this project, whichever solution we choose. We have in our fiscal year 17 CIP, $7.9 million, and then we're going to be proposing to the board another $10 million in FY18. Midcoast, because they will be purchasing ticket vending machines and validators, and they'll be part of the fare collection system, Sandag will be giving us some money, and they have set aside about $8 million, I think, for that purpose. And then finally, NCTD shares in the fare collection system, and so they would be also contributing. So next generation vendors was the next chapter in the white paper. The big takeaways from this is that you really want to be certain that you pick the right vendor, the right system integrator. So you do your due diligence to really understand what their products are and what they offer. A number of vendors offer the account-based type of system. Cubic has launched it, as I mentioned, in Chicago, and VIX as well has also fully implemented this type of system. Portland will shortly launch with Init, and that's one of the vendors that is trying to make it into the U.S. market. There's a matrix on page 36 of the white paper if you want to understand more about the different vendors. The vendor's experience level is really important for the success of our implementation, and so that is something we would look into as we make our decisions. So the recommendation from the white paper is that we go forward with developing a concept of operations. I'm not going to detail for you, it's on this slide, but this would be sort of a way to really get an in-depth study as to what we want. in our fare collection system. This will help us whether we implement a cubic upgrade or if we go forward with a full procurement to try to get a, you know, a best value vendor. The cost for this, I do have a cost proposal that's about between $250,000 to $300,000. I have asked CH2 to go back and revisit that because I feel like we could probably reduce the effort. And the estimated time for this would be between 4 and 6 months. In the meantime, we're going to be moving forward with the fare study over with Sandag, and we are exploring security-related efforts with Cubic. This is just a really great way of looking at how long it takes to implement a new fare collection system. I would tell you this because, really, if we get started today with the concept of operations, we can have all of this done well in time for the launch of Midcoast. And so that's kind of like a really good goal for us, just because it's less complicated for the opening of that extension of our Blue Line. Now I'm going to turn into Robert Borowski from our IT department, and he's going to discuss what we've been doing up to date with our PCI compliance.
Thank you, Sharon. The latest thing we did was after our last discussion is we decided to do a gap analysis with a security expert. We hired a firm called Applied Trust, and we worked through what the limitations of the current system are. From that gap analysis, we found out that there were improvements we could make to the existing system, but that there were some limitations without upgrading the payment platform. And really that was the key takeaway, is that regardless of what we do, the payment platform has to be upgraded at some point. That said, through prioritizing some of the remediation efforts, we were able to already start working on this, and we've already addressed some of the issues. If you take a look at the next slide, this kind of outlines those findings that we had. So PCI is a kind of a moving target. They update the requirements every 2 years. So the current version is 3.2. And as Sharon mentioned earlier, there's 12 generic requirements. That never changes, but the controls that make up those requirements change from version to version. So when we took a line-by-line look at all those controls, and when what we were able to deduce is that as of today, we were able to cover about 30% of those things. So one way of looking at that bar down there, if that's 100% compliant, we're about 30% compliant as of today. The two additional bars, the red and the green, what you see, are efforts that we can do in parallel, and we can begin those today. 37% of those controls we feel are things that we can begin working on immediately, involving procedures, training staff, documentation, just general payment security issues that are required of any agency doing this. At the same time, we still have that issue, though, that we know about 34% of the system, we can't address it right now. It has to require a system upgrade to the payment platform. And so the options we have on the next slide here, and Sharon kind of touched on some of this already, but we could do a new fare system deployment, and this could be Cubic designed or anyone else, but either way we'd require that remediation to happen in the background. As Sharon mentioned, Cubic's provided some proposals, both on-site and cloud-based. We found no difference between the two with regards to PCI compliance. Either one would be a viable option. They're similar in cost as well. Again, the key point to understand, though, is that only accounts for about 30-34% of the compliance issues that we'll need to address internally. So in parallel, we want to continue working on these other issues. And then just the last point I'd like to make is that any next generation system that Sharon had just talked about, we would obviously build in functional requirements that it would have to be PCI compliant from the get-go. So
I'll switch gears and talk about how we're updating stored value. We ran into some glitches in trying to implement it. We're in the final state testing stage right now, however. We've kind of resolved, we think, knock on wood, the concerns we had. We're doing a limited live pilot with employees right now. And if all goes well, we think we can launch in mid to late January. The product would be available for purchase at the transit store as well as at all ticket vending machines. And then we're going to be marketing it as Compass Cash, very flashy. And with that, I will take questions.
There it goes. Great. Sean, I want to make sure I understand this correctly, and it's probably obvious to most people, but if we just continue to do the upgrades, is that just sort of pushing the inevitable farther and farther in advance, sort of like nursing an old car, replacing the motors on and on until finally you realize you have to get a new one?
Do you want to answer?
The answer is like not yes or no.
I understand it more.
One of the issues, and one of the issues that we're proceeding the way we are, is that in some respects we are where we were in 2000, that the industry is changing, technology is evolving, and only a couple of people have dipped their toe in the water. And we were one of those back in 2002. And here we are in 2017, and we're still trying to implement all the aspects of it, okay? So the maturation of technology in terms of a broad-based solution to this, i.e. account-based, is limited in its application out there running in an everyday environment. I think we all understand that we'd like to get there, and we want to get there because it offers so much more functionality and ease of use, et cetera. It essentially goes to a bank, to a cash system on a card. And, you know, if you just want to ride once a month, you can do that. If you want to ride 100 times a month, it charges every time until it gets to a level, and then it caps it at a monthly pass or a half monthly pass or however you set it, or it could be five times in a day and setting at a day pass. So it's very flexible. But we have to do some things. Sharon referred to real-time communication. What that means is right now in the trolleys, since you see all these variable message signs, we have real-time communication with all the trolleys. We'll have to do that with all the buses. And that's not a cheap thing. It's basically a cell service in every vehicle. We see a lot of applications positively for doing that kind of thing, maintenance applications, monitoring of engines and stuff, a whole bunch of things. But that's something that we'd have to do. Systems like Chicago don't do that, and they pay the price for it. So, you know, we want to get there, but we want to do it in the right way, and something that's not going to be a huge issue for our customers, and that we proceed. And that's why I think at this point what we want to do is we just want to study what our future is much more carefully and put much more meat on the bones, so that the next step after that would either be to sit down with Cubic from a very educated standpoint and negotiate where we go forward, or we develop a specific RFP to go out on the street. And even if we do that, we might opt back for Cubic. So, yeah, we've got a couple of things. I mean, we could do the upgrade, as Sharon said, in option A, and just wait for 5 or 6 years and wait for the technology to mature and set a direction so that it's much more off the shelf. We could take a position where we do that, but we get the next fare, or the what do they call that, next account as an accessory to what we have that's fully negotiated, and we understand exactly what it does, but we turn it on increment by increment till we get to that point. Or if we feel that starting afresh is the way to go, we'll have that option. And we'll be coming back to you in the spring with all those choices and our evaluation in which way we should go.
Anyone else want to comment?
I should also make another comment. When we talked about card-based systems versus account-based systems, one of the challenges that we had when Sharon said we had some issues with stored value. It's because Cubic and us, we make the software changes to implement stored value, and then they get pushed out to all the hardware in the field. So we've got 200 TVMs and, I don't know, 400 pieces, those little silver things, and 800 fare boxes. And so it all gets whapped out there via the, you know, via the air. And what we found is that a bunch of PSIDs didn't accept the new software, so it wouldn't work. So we had to go back into every single one of those and figure out why won't it accept it and resolve it. That's a big issue with respect to account-based, which means you just go into the computer, you make all those changes, and then it's there. It functions, as opposed to the card base where it's all hardware oriented. So there's a lot of detail, but, you know.
Mr. Meadow.
Just make sure I understand this. The word wasn't actually used, but like Paul was talking about how it's sent out or whapped out. It's a new technical term, I guess. Is this like a cloud-based kind of operation that we're talking about that distributes the functionality?
It would be if you went with the type of account base you're right. talking about.
And then also,
just one add-on onto that. Excuse me, cloud-based system too provides us an opportunity to shift a lot more liability to the vendor.
Right.
Okay. We can host it. If we were to go to upgrade, we could host it internally like we do right now, or they can implement the Cubic, let's say, could implement the cloud-based, and they'd be responsible for the software, PCI compliance, and all of that. And I think it would reduce our PCI compliance percentage that we talked about. But so we're looking at that too.
Okay. And then also, just to kind of piggyback on what you're talking about is, we could wait to jump into this 5 or 6 years from now, or we can be on the leading edge of it. And I guess in my little brain here is what I'm thinking is, how can we get something out of this other than just the fact that we're on the cutting edge? For instance, this portion where we can get into the next generation of it, is that for free, for instance? Or if because the way I see it is, we're really funding a corporation to develop software that is really not out anywhere else. And like any organization that pays for the development of some kind of technology or, you know, some tangible item, they generally get some kind of residual off of that. So can we make a deal where we actually, if 50 transit systems throughout the United States of the world, they implement this, what's our cut of the pie since we're funding the new technology? It might be a little bit too simple, you know, or maybe I'm just way out there, but I'm just thinking about how we're going to make money for our system here without always getting money from the fares or some other little things. So just a thought.
I'll let Alan comment because he's got much more practical. But my own assessment is, while that's nice to think about, it never happens.
Well, that's my point.
Because every system out there, even if they go with Cubic as the same vendor, they always want like a brand new application for what they do as opposed to what San Diego does, as opposed to what Minneapolis does. And so they charge again for all that software development. That's how they make money. But maybe I'm more jaundiced than Alan Mike.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. If you go to most APTA conferences, there will be a session exactly on your topic. So it's very common. The short answer really is what Paul said. There's a lot of, even though a lot of projects have similarities and very similar challenges, there is a lot of unique features to each agency. So, you know, to kind of, you know, on the vendor side, there is quite a bit of custom development for each property. That being said, part of the reason we had that chapter in the white paper on vendor experience is specifically to address your concern, which is you know, we generally don't want to be in the situation where we're funding a first-time vendor doing technology for the first time and basically having, you know, providing like an R&D type of budget. So there are, like Sharon said, Cubic has implemented one account-based system in the U.S. that's implemented. VIX is another vendor that did one in Salt Lake City. They were actually the first. And speaking of Salt Lake City, they can give you lots of stories about their funding of that particular technology. There are several projects in works as we speak. So within 2 years, there should be three more relatively large projects in the U.S. That we're working on two of them that could provide a lot of lessons learned and help mitigate some of that risk, your concern, which is, you know, we don't want to go with the vendor who's doing this for the first time. And we're very, very cognizant of that. And it's an age-old challenge across these fair collection systems because, like Paul said, technology changes so fast in this space that pretty much almost any time you launch, there will be a type of technology or process that really hasn't been done in other places. So that was a long way of saying we're you know, aware of your concern, and you know, the white paper reflects some of our thoughts on how to address it.
And I think, and our goal is, as much as we'd like to develop something and be able to sell it, our goal really is to pick somebody who has done it and it works, and we know if we pick them, while we may have to make some changes, that it's not that big of a leap, and that we're very confident that with a lesser effort, we can get something that functions very well.
Well, I guess one of my concerns is, you know, I understand all that stuff that you're talking about, but we're talking about a lot of money over 10 years. And so what happens in 10 years? Do we come back to the drawing board and now we're putting out another $25 million or whatever that was, I forget off the top of my head, to do this all over again? Or are we developing a technology that is that flexible to continuously add modules or components that have been updated over the years? Because that's, to me, the way the technology is going for the future. It's not like today we're refining oil, we're not making steel, we're not creating things that are necessarily tangible that you hold in your hand, but it's intellectual property that is, for lack of a better term, intellectual. So that's a lot easier to update than to retool a factory.
No, absolutely. So that question really cuts to the core of our major recommendation, which is the open architecture feature in the white paper. So if you haven't had a chance, if you look at the open architecture section, you know, in our opinion, that's actually the most important feature of your next system. And it exactly addresses your concern, which is in the future, if we want to make upgrades or selective improvements to the system, we don't necessarily have to go back to the original vendor, and we can do incremental updates or updates on components that we know are no longer useful. So using today's system as an example, if an open architecture was proposed when this original system was launched, and to be fair, when this system was launched, open architecture wasn't really a practice in the industry, so it's not like it was available and we didn't choose it. It just was a feature that evolved through necessity. But using this example, if we had an open architecture, we could potentially replace our back end, which would provide that PCI compliance that Robert was talking about, and maintain other elements of the system. I'm simplifying this example. But basically, it allows the flexibility for the agency to purchase off-the-shelf components or integrate with other third-party components without having to buy a whole new system. And we've seen that in practice at a couple of agencies around the country on a smaller scale, but certainly it's something that's relatively new, but we think that's the most important feature that we should be focusing on in the next generation system. And like Paul said, that could be something that you can get with Cubic or with another vendor. It's more of a contractual ownership type feature as opposed to a technology feature. It's the rights to the intellectual property. That's really what you're purchasing.
I was pretty sure that's what that meant, but I just want to make sure because, you know, we're going to vote on this. I want to make sure that I'm fully informed as well as, you know, my colleagues here, so I appreciate that.
And one other aspect of it is we're recommending open payment ready. So in other words, maybe you don't want to launch all these other functionalities. Maybe you don't want to allow them to use their debit card to purchase fares, but you want a system that's going to be ready for that if the board's decision is to go in that direction.
Well, I can tell you right now, people my age like to use cash. Well, a lot of them do. But people that are younger, they want to have that functionality. And if we're going to try and draw them in, we're going to have to give them that functionality, in my opinion.
At OPRC and architecture, I think the one best example that I always use is that our ticket vending machines, Cubic has one ticket vending machine. It costs about $100,000, okay? There are other types of machinery that we can put out at stations that have maybe not all the functionality, because a ticket vending machine can do everything. We don't always need everything. Maybe we need one that has everything and one that just uses credit card or just issues tickets. They don't make that hardware. Other people do at a fraction of the cost. So if we had the APIs or the software connection capabilities, we can buy that hardware, plug it into our system, and be spending less money.
Oh, yes, Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you. I want to start off by saying that I really commend you on the report, Sharon, this and obviously the consultant team. There is a lot of really, really great information, and it really puts everything into perspective for us as far as what we have as options. And I think what you're looking for is maybe some feedback as to what comes next, or maybe you already have a recommendation. But I think that I'll go through some of my questions, but I wanted to start off by saying that I think this information is quite thorough and just gives you like a real, like, it's an eye-opener as to what we can get ourselves into and perhaps what we have to get ourselves into to go into the future. And like Mr. Minto said, he carries around cash. I absolutely don't. I pay with my phone. I just swipe up, and there's my credit card, and I touch it with my fingerprint, and I get charged at the grocery store. And so, you know, things are changing, certainly from the customer perspective, and we want to be able to address the changing behavior by customers. And I'll get to the PCI and stored value. Well, maybe not stored value as much, as it seems like there's significant progress, which is great, but PCI at the end. My first couple of questions, and this, shame on me for not knowing this, but what is the size of our MTS? You use the peer groups to compare us to in terms of riders, in terms of operations and all that. What are our numbers? What are our annual ridership numbers for our system?
Our annual number is about 93 million.
Okay.
And then our daily is about almost 300,000 currently.
Okay. And what is our annual revenue from, I guess, fare collection?
Fare collection, it's, in FY16, it was 106 million, I think.
Okay.
Just a comment, if you're looking at the peers that we get,
yeah.
It wasn't solely done by system size.
Right.
We wanted to make sure that we had a representative of people that are using all the vendors out there.
Yeah.
So we had Xerox, and we had Init, and Cubic, and Vix, and all of those.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It just helps me sort of, you know, think of it that way a little bit. What, let's see, I think I'm going to go to page 12 on your slide. Oh, yeah, that one right there.
Mm-hmm.
The first question is, how or when is the customer experience analyzed as part of either this white paper or on a going forward basis?
Was this slide 12 or?
That, starting there is fine.
Okay.
It, there's nothing specifically, I wrote my note on the slide, so.
We've done customer satisfaction surveys, I think every year for the last several years. And that was a distinct question within those surveys.
In terms of how you want to
How satisfied they are with the system.
Okay. My question is more towards the, like, what do you want to see in the system or change, or what do you like about the system best? How, like, at any point, do we as part of this going forward, did we analyze this as part of this white paper? I don't think we did because there was no results. But
no.
If we go forward, how do we engage people on the end user side?
Do you want to talk about experiences at other agencies?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. And so as part of the concept of operations, that will be an element of the next phase. But a general kind of lesson learned that we've seen at some other properties is that we do rely a lot of the staff experience to reflect some of the customer experience. So for example, a representative from customer service and marketing and any staff who interfaces with customers on a regular basis, we look to them to reflect a lot of the customer experience. The second part to that is we do find that generally it is good to have kind of a skeleton of a recommendation or vision to present to the customers as opposed to asking a blank question sometimes, right? Because when you do that, sometimes you can get obviously a variety of answers. I mean, this is a really great example. You know, you can have one customer say, I only use cash. You have another customer say, I never use cash. Right. So starting from the beginning, we do rely on staff to kind of set up the skeleton, like Paul was saying, and then present that and say, what do you think about these features? Or is there anything missing? And that's kind of generally how we approach it. We've seen that be effective at other places. But it's definitely an extremely important, probably the most important stakeholder in this whole process. It's just the timing of the involvement. Usually getting it too early can branch off in a lot of different ways.
Okay, appreciate that. On slide 13, which I think is one of the one that presents some of the most crucial findings of the white paper, or at least part of the report, I think those are all really important to keep in mind. Specifically, the first to last bullet, the contract negotiation being critical to minimize the risk. Who would take that lead on that? And obviously, you know, we'd have staff from MTS, but how would we get that expertise from someone who's going to help us minimize the risk?
Well, we would probably hire a consultant who has done this with other agencies as well to assist us in the negotiations. And then it would have to incorporate all of the different disciplines within MTS to make sure that we're covering every detail we need.
Okay. On slide 14, we talk about the account-based system, which I think I sense, but correct me if I'm wrong, Sharon, this is what you suggest, or maybe the report suggests, this is what we should go to at some point?
Well, what we would definitely want is to have that availability, you know, so that when we wanted to add these different types of functionalities to allow them to purchase, we would want to have those functionalities. But the real benefit right off the bat for an account-based system is that you don't have to manage the hardware as much. You mm-hmm. don't have to worry that you push something out and you have to touch every piece of hardware on the system. It allows us to have a lot more reliability as well. So that would be something that, the white paper points us in the direction that's something we really want to see.
Okay. And remind me, under option either one or A and option B or option two, do we get account-based systems or not?
That would be option B under the Cubic proposals.
Okay. Or if we went through an RFP process,
correct.
Right? Okay. Slide 15, the integration with other transit systems and parking systems, which I think that'd be awesome. Does that also, I assume that could also include any other type of fare collection system, like the one they use for the fast lanes on the freeways?
Yeah,
it would be essentially anything.
Right, like, okay. As long as you could interface the two systems. They'd have to have a certain type of modern system in order to get it to speak to one another,
Okay, and the last point there on greater flexibility in fare policy, could we do demand pricing since it's so automatic?
Yeah, I don't know that anybody's doing demand pricing, but are they doing off-peak?
You mean like
pricing?
Peak and off-peak?
Right.
It's certainly possible. In an account-based system, like Sharon says, your fare rules are controlled in the back end, so they are a lot more flexible than a card-based system. There are peak and off-peak prices, certainly, at other agencies. So that's a common practice. And if you talk about changing them on the fly or making them a little more dynamic, that is certainly a technical feature. But obviously, any fair policies would have to go before the board and
right.
go through Title VI and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. On 17, slide 17, the this is where I wrote down a note of what the numbers are compared to MTS. So the $36 million cost for Portland in terms of riders and the system size, how are compared to that, where do you think we fall?
Very close.
Like very similar? Okay. How much do you think the NCTD share would amount to under the funding available, potential funding available?
Well, whenever we do these systems, it really depends on the system. We share other software with NCTD, but in general, it would be like 25% type thing.
Okay. What is that in, like?
In real dollars.
Yeah. And I won't hold you to the number, but it gives me a just sense.
So, I mean, if it's...
So if this system cost, let's just use Portland since we fall, sort of $35 million, it would be 25% of that?
Right.
Okay.
And again, hardware is a big component in the price tag, so it would depend on how many ticket vending machines they have on their platforms,
right.
as well as how many pieces, validators they have,
okay.
and fare boxes, if they want to replace the fare boxes on the buses.
Okay, so that cost has not been associated to the Chapter 4 where you have the potential costs, or is it?
It is. It's a real rough estimate.
Right.
It's based on what they have in the system today.
Okay.
You know, so we included North County's numbers in there, we included our
okay.
numbers in there, but I couldn't give you a real breakdown on what the different I guess we could get into the specifics on it if you wanted, but of what their ticket vending machines
yeah.
cost versus ours.
Yeah, probably not now, but is there an ability, and this probably obviously would need board approval, but to do convenience fees to customers who use like credit cards as often the case, and I don't know if this is market research, but if you use a credit card, you're often willing to pay an extra fee for the convenience of it. Is that something that could be added or that other systems do?
We just had that conversation 2 days ago. Because the one thing that we have to be cognizant of, the more we use credit cards and electronic payments, mm-hmm. we have to pay a commission.
Right.
And when we start to market our cards in grocery stores like Nordstrom's and Macy's and Olive Garden and all those places, we're going to have to pay a commission. So we are going to talk about transaction fees or, you know, fees. And I'll say it now, with WebTix, which is our, online version or function to buy things, we're going through an overhaul of that right now to address security issues, and that's we're going to have to start paying commissions on that too because of the credit card. So we're thinking about whether we can do a transaction fee on that. Might be relatively small, but one that recovers our costs.
Okay. On 21, which gives us the projected schedule, I can't read it here, and I couldn't read it on the screen. How many years is this? 5 years? A potential 5-year
yeah.
rolling out?
Yes,
okay.
5 years. But that actually, we're going to point to where we are right now,
uh-huh.
we're like right here.
Okay. So we're almost 1 year down.
Yeah.
Okay. And Midcoast launches when?
2021.
Okay. So it'd be right around that time.
But we think if we went with a cubic type solution, we could probably get it done quicker.
Yeah.
Our goal is to get it done by Midcoast.
Correct.
Right. And you need to install those machines and all that, right? So that requires some time.
Yeah. The installation of the machines, we can do that ourselves, our staff.
Okay.
And it doesn't really take as much time as you would think.
Okay. On the PCI compliance matter, 24 is the slide that sort of gives you the summary. What does the last bullet mean, that we only if we go with a next generation system will we have full PCI compliance? Is that what that's saying?
No, it actually is just saying that if you go with a next generation, it will be
capable of full PCI compliance.
So what does third bullet say mean when it says, however, these proposals alone do not produce the complete PCI compliance system and would still leave 37% of the controls to be addressed?
Because there's things like our standard operating procedures, how we handle when we take a phone call at the customer service center, you know, and somebody gives us a credit card, how we're handling that kind of thing. So,
oh, okay. So it's not the system that has a 37% gap. It's a gap that we fill no matter what.
Right.
Processes.
Process. All right. And lastly, really, really happy to see slide 25 on the stored value update. You said available at transit stores, at vending machines, but it won't be on the mobile app then? Or is that already something you can do on the mobile app because you can buy different amounts?
The mobile app will be itself. Yeah. That'll be standalone.
Right.
The only thing that's missing from here is the WebTix, which is doing it online, which I think is going to be a big, but and that's going to come. It's just going to come next. And it'll probably be as early as spring, just a couple of months after, but because we're redoing this WebTix, and we have to have the new security measures in place before we want to allow this stored value component to be done on the web.
Right. Thank you for allowing me to the time to ask answer those questions. I appreciate the responses. I think my only comment would be we should build a system that makes sense for us, and while it'd be nice to get some dividends if somebody else uses the system, I think that should be our primary focus, and whatever it takes to get us to that system that we want is the way we should go. Supportive of your proposal to move forward in developing the concept of operations, and I think after that we can decide what we need to do. So, thank you again.
Anyone else want to weigh in? Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Wywood.
When you described concept of operations and you gave a bogey of 250 to 300K, and then you said it might be less than that. Given that this is the next milestone and you said that investment of time up front is the most, has the best payback, which I think we all understand, can you maybe go into a little more detail about, I assume today what we're doing, being asked to do is to approve going forward with the development of the concept of operations.
Yeah, we'd have to come back to the board to procure that consulting work. So that would come later. We really wanted to get your feedback about that. I mean, another option would just be to say, go forward with the CUBIC system or create an RFP and do it in-house. You know, so those are the types of things. But these are the types of things that you're looking at in a concept of operations. And a lot of that can be worked on in-house, where we do it, you know, like we're not stopping the work ourselves just because we don't have a consultant kind of leading us in that direction. So I just wanted to say that I feel like there's certain things that can be done that we could pull out of that proposal that we did receive.
Well, I'd be, though I won't be sitting here at the time, I'd be really excited to see this concept of operations fleshed out. That's really going to be key to answering all the questions that are coming up here.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the report. I think a very meaningful discussion, and we'll see you back here before too long. Thank you. We'll move on now to the next item on the agenda, and that is the Operation Budget Status Report for October 2016, and we'll welcome Mike Thompson up for that.
Good morning. As always, I have Lucas Kramer with me to answer the really tough questions. We're looking at the financial results for the first 4 months of the fiscal year through October 31st, 2016. Looking at operating revenues first, operating revenues were unfavorable to budget by $2.2 million, almost 6% variance. This is all in passenger fare revenue. As I mentioned last month, with the final FY16 results, our target for FY17 is much more difficult to attain. We're actually, instead of having flat growth, which we planned on having this year, we actually have to have $3 million of growth based on the way the budgets are fell at the end of 16. And right now, we're unfavorable to the prior year by almost over 5%, almost $2 million. So that target and the budget target for the fare revenues is probably unattainable at this point. We're having trouble keeping up with last year. And we're keeping an eye on that to see how that goes over the course of the year, but that is a very big concern at this point in time. The $2.7 million fare revenue unfavorable variance is being partially offset by almost $500,000 of other operating revenues. That's favorable variances in advertising and in within rail operations as well. On the operating expense side, we continue to have a favorable variance on operating expenses. It's over $1.8 million in total, 2% favorable variance. The large majority of this is in personnel costs, which favorable variance is within administration and also directly operated bus wages and fringe benefits. And then we're also favorable in other outside services. That's in repairs and maintenance and engines, transmissions, and a lot of different areas. Now, that type of stuff tends to be lumpy. It tends to come in waves. So that favorable variance now may or may not continue through the course of the year. Energy, we're favorable by $123,000, very slight favorable variance. We'll talk about those rates on a future slide. And then other expenses are favorable by $292,000, 4.4%, and that's primarily within risk management costs so far the first 4 months of the year. Again, $1.8 million in total. That partially offsets the overall operating revenue variance. So in total, we are unfavorable to budget by almost $400,000, 0.7% for the first 4 months of the year. Now, this just looks at the operating budgets. We don't really talk about subsidy results until we get towards the end of the year. So we do have an ongoing concern slide where we try to keep some of these other major drivers on top of mind. Our sales tax generated revenue, as with passenger revenue, the targets missing last year's numbers makes the targets for this year's numbers harder to achieve. So most likely we will not achieve those numbers as well. We are projecting a large unfavorable variances on all the sales tax generated revenues. We did receive a new state transit assistance update from the state of California a couple weeks ago. They are forecasting $13.1 million for MTS for this current fiscal year. We had initially budgeted $14.5 million last spring. So there's an unfavorable variance there. We did get our first payment on time, which was a positive development this year from STA. We already talked about passenger levels and passenger fare revenue. Those are going hand in hand, unfavorable for the year so far. Energy prices, we do have some favorable variance to energy prices, mostly on the diesel and gasoline side. The CNG prices are coming up, but we think we'll be able to maintain budget on the CNG prices. And then electricity prices have been fairly steady with what we budgeted, so that part we think should be on target for the course of the year. But the main concerns are the revenue drivers, sales taxes, and passengers. That completes the presentation. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions, comments? Okay. Thank you, Mike. Go on now to the report on the transit operation plan, which we call TOP, and here's Dennis Desmond who will make the report.
Good morning, thank you. I'd like to give an update this morning on our transit optimization plan. This is a project that we started earlier this year. We last came to you in September with a contract award for transportation management and design to be our consultant on this project. This is a 10-year update of our comprehensive operational analysis that we did in the 06-07 timeframe, where we took a look at our entire system, all of our resources and how they were allocated, and really did a complete remake of our system to better allocate resources where they are better used by more riders. So we started this project in early September when we had an almost month-long public survey. We went out and talked to passengers in various places. We went to community groups, organizations, and did a very significant outreach and data collection effort. We're following that up now with some service proposals that we're going to begin working on with TMD in December and January, and coming up with an implementation plan, and then moving on to implementation in the middle of next year, starting in the middle of next year, going through 2018. So our community survey in September was primarily online. We did take manual surveys, but mostly done online. And we actually had almost 4,000 responses, which is really unprecedented for this type of a survey for us. Not only that, but over 1,700 of those responses are people that don't even ride our system now. So we really made an effort to outreach to people that aren't riding our system to find out reasons why our system isn't useful to them. So. It was an anonymous survey, so we don't know exactly who responded and how, but from IP addresses, we saw a lot of responses from UC San Diego community, San Diego Community College District campuses, Qualcomm, and the Balboa Park and Zoo areas. So to talk a little bit about some of the results of the survey, when you look at our current riders, and over 2,000 of our current riders responded, about 50% of them said that they ride about the same as they did last year. And in spite of our current ridership trend, actually a third of them said they ride more frequently than they did last year. So we wanted to drill down a little bit on the 10% that said that they ride less frequently and why. About a quarter of them said their travel needs had changed, they'd gotten a new job, they'd relocated, et cetera. Some of them said that there were new better alternatives, either they'd started driving or using other alternatives to transit. But really, the largest percentage of people, almost a third of the people, said that it was the time that it took to use transit and the convenience of using transit. And as I go through some of these other slides, you're going to see this is a theme that comes up over and over, is the time and convenience of using transit. In terms of the fare and the safety and comfort and amenities, those ranked much lower than some of the others. For the people that are using alternatives, we asked them what they were doing instead, and over 60% said that they were driving instead. So this really speaks to the fact that gas prices probably have a bigger impact than we might have imagined on our ridership. And then you can see on the right side, the chart, there's other people that are doing carpooling or taxis or walking, et cetera. We ask people what their biggest challenges of using MTS, either current riders, the difficulties that they see, or people that don't ride MTS, why they don't ride. You can see that the over on the left side on the top, service not being frequent enough really rose to the top as one of the really major impediments that people have to using our system. And then another one right next to that is that it's too many transfers or it takes too long. And we kind of combine those into one. But really, that's, again, the time and convenience factor. We did have a fair number of people that said that the service doesn't run early or late enough for them, or it doesn't get close enough to them. These factors down in the bottom, and the way this reads is that these are the ones or people that ranked that as the number one issue, the number of people that ranked that as the number two issue, et cetera. So you can see down on the bottom here, other factors like security, cleanliness, the fare, not enough parking at transit stations. Many more people ranked these as five, sixes, and sevens rather than ones, twos, and threes. So these really fell to the bottom, whereas the service quantity and frequency and time and convenience, again, rise to the top as ones, twos, and threes in people's mind. We also wanted to know what people preferred when given a choice among how we could allocate our resources and redesign our system. So over 80% said that they actually preferred a shorter overall travel time than fewer connections. And when it gets to system design, this is actually an important distinction because we can make very long circuitous routes that give many people a one-seat ride, but that ends up taking a lot longer for people. whereas we can provide more frequent services on shorter routes that require more connections, and people seemed okay with that as long as their overall trip time wasn't impacted based on this result. We asked them about more frequent service versus a lower fare, a lower pass price. Almost two-thirds said they preferred frequency over a lower fare. We asked them about more frequent service versus a shorter walk to transit. And actually over two-thirds said that they preferred more frequent service even if it meant that they needed to walk a little bit longer to get to a bus stop. We asked about the speed of service versus lower fare, and over two-thirds again preferred the faster service over reduced fare. We asked about service frequency and security, and actually almost three-quarters preferred more frequency over us adding more security resource. And then we asked about frequency versus amenities like benches and shelters and bus stop improvements, and again, three-quarters preferred the service and frequency over those items. Real quickly, looking at the distribution of our survey, about half of our survey respondents came from the Central San Diego area, and most of the rest were pretty evenly split between the South Bay, East County, North City communities, and the beach areas, and then we had some from the NCTD service area and outside as well. The second item is, and actually the first thing we had TMD do was to look at the market analysis. And this is really critical. This is one of the main items of the comprehensive operational analysis initially, was to see where our service fits in versus where the markets are. So we wanted to define that context geographically for coming up with our service design. This map up here shows the current, or 2020, housing and employment density. So the brown dots represent employment density and the yellow dots represent residential density. So you can see some areas such as the Kearny Mesa area, UTC, Miramar Road area, very, very heavily tilted towards employment. As well as along the bayfront, and then a little bit in the East County community and down in Otay Mesa. And then residential communities are almost completely separated from that. You don't see a lot of mixing of brown and yellow dots here. And what we did is compared this to where we're going in 2050. So I'm going to slip to 2050 real quick, and you'll see the change here. And there's 2050. The interesting thing is that this is very different from what we saw 10 years ago with the COA. There was much more intention of the region growing outward into the surrounding areas, and what you're seeing is a lot more growth, a lot more densification within the existing urbanized area. Over half of the new housing will be in the central San Diego area. As we add about 500,000 jobs and over 300,000 housing units. And one of the real big opportunities that we see in the future is that more than 60% of people are anticipated to live near high-frequency transit. So that's almost double what we have today. So that represents a real good potential opportunity for the future. Looking at population and employment, this is another way of looking at where we have residents. Residential development versus employment density. And one thing that is really striking about this, with the green shades being residential and then the brown and yellow shades being employment, is that, again, they're very distinct and very separate. You don't see a lot of mixing between the two. You don't see a lot of block groups that are residential right next to block groups that are employment. So what this means is that people are traveling to get to work. And this has a lot of implications for how we design the system, and we'll show a few more that show this as well. So we looked at areas that have high job to population ratios. So these are areas where they do have a lot of jobs where people are living. And what you can see is that Kearny Mesa actually has almost 13 jobs for every resident. So obviously a lot of people coming into the Kearny Mesa area, and that's the highest in the region. But we also have some other very high areas that have more jobs than they have residents. Downtown, University City, Mission Valley area, and Torrey Pines area as well. We looked at areas that have low jobs population ratios. So these are areas where people, for the most part, have to travel outside of the area that they live to get to work. So areas that ranked very low with for example, less than 0.1 jobs per resident in Canto. Then other areas, Golden Hill, Normal Heights, some of the central San Diego areas, you see the same thing, as well as some of the South Bay communities. And then Tierra Santa is also on there, is very low. Looking at the inner city commute trends, these are the number of people that live and work in the same city, in, shown in blue, versus the number of people that work and live in different cities. San Diego, obviously being very big, has a very high percentage, but these could be people that are, for example, living in San Ysidro and working in Rancho Bernardo. So because of the size of San Diego, that skews it a little bit. When you take San Diego out of it, we're really at about 10%. So that's a very low number of people that actually live and work in the same community in San Diego. So most people are traveling. That's a challenge and an opportunity for us. Looking at some of the demographic data that TMD has come up with us, this is a density map showing where seniors live. And the darker green, the higher density of seniors. And what you see is very, very few areas of dark green or even a darker shade of green on here. This means that the seniors are very spread out through the entire community. This is a huge challenge for us. Seniors are a big potential source of ridership for us. So when we see it so spread out like this, it's really challenging for us to group enough people to make a really solid service for seniors in the region. When you look at youth density, you see very much the same thing. Youth, again, are a good, very potential ridership source for transit. A lot of them aren't driving yet. These are people between the ages of 10 and 17. It's about 10% of the population, but you'll see it's only about 5% of our ridership. Again, very highly dispersed throughout the region. You see a little bit of some darker shades in the San Ysidro area, the mid-city community in El Cajon, but otherwise it's very dispersed throughout the entire region. You see, similar with college age density, a little bit here you start to see a little bit of density in the UCSD, SDSU, and USD areas. Otherwise, again, dispersed through the region. Looking at the density of minorities, minorities are a majority of the population. 55% of the region's population is minority. And one of the primary reasons for showing this is because whenever we make major changes to our system, we do have to compare that to the minority populations and densities within our service area. So this does have an impact on how we can design services in our region. Low income density, this does also show some densification through the South Bay communities, San Ysidro, Western Chula Vista, and National City. The southern San Diego area, the mid-city area, and East County in the central El Cajon area, as well as up right around UCSD, where you have a large population of students living. We looked at zero vehicle households. These are households that don't have a vehicle available to them. And this is more common in the denser communities, downtown, North Park, City Heights, and then some of the South Bay communities, Western Chula Vista, National City, San Ysidro. So this is very similar to the, in terms of where you see the densification to the income levels. Looking at population growth, past and projected, you can see in the past 15 years, the highest population has been in Chula Vista as it's expanded eastward. That's going to slow down, projected to slow down in the next 30 years, and you'll see a lot more growth in, for example, National City. You'll see the pace of growth in San Diego faster than it has been in the past, and this is as we really densify our communities and you see a lot more growth and population going into the already built-up urbanized area, which I think is a good opportunity for us in the future. Wanted to show a quick slide on the border crossings because this question always comes up. The border is so important to us in terms of our ridership. And you can see overall over the past 10 years, the border crossings have gone up, although they dipped in 2015. But one of the big takeaways from this slide is you can see the growth in the blue band, which is the Otay Mesa crossing. We just earlier today made permanent our trial changes to our Route 950 Express service to the Otay Mesa port of entry. And you can see the people that that's really serving is that large blue band there that's really grown over the last 5 years. And lastly, on the demographics, just looking at the age trends, again, about 60% of our bus and trolley ridership is between 19 and 34 years old. About 10% on the bus side and 7% on the trolley side are seniors, and then about 4% are 18 and younger. So remember, that was 10% of the total population, but it's only about 5% of our ridership. So some key findings from that market analysis. Again, the growth and densification over the next 30 years is really going to be more densely concentrated in the urbanized area. Most of the cities in our region have low jobs to population ratio, meaning that people are traveling. And there's also a lack of diversification of land use, so you don't see a lot of mixing of residential and employment areas. Youth and senior densities are very highly dispersed throughout the entire region, making it challenging for us to offer services that tailor to those populations. And then the areas of high transit propensity that we saw during the COA are really similar to what they are today. So the next phase of TMD's analysis was to evaluate our current services. So this is to provide us some context for how we're doing and to look at our key performance indicators to hopefully improve on those as we do some system changes during the TOP. Just looking at historical trends since the COA, our ridership has actually grown slightly higher, faster than the population of our region, so that's actually been positive. You can see the COA started in 2006, 2007, and how not only ridership, but also productivity, the number of riders per hour of service that we're putting out on the street has grown since the COA. Looking at our ridership by time of day, there are some peaks around the 6 a.m. hour, and then again between the about the 3 and 4 p.m. hour, you see some higher peaks here. One thing that's really interesting to note about our region, and we've always seen this traditionally, is if you were to look at traditional large cities with very heavy centralized business districts, you'd see these spikes much, much higher, and the dip in the middle of the day much lower. So that's what we call our peak-to-base ratio. So you'd see the base much lower and the peaks much higher in other cities. So we're a lot flatter here in San Diego, meaning we have a lot more midday ridership compared to peak hour ridership than they do in other areas. And that's really mirrored on the bus and trolley both. So I'll go through the weekday ridership, Saturday ridership, and Sunday ridership. You'll see the maps change. This is the weekday ridership, where you see the concentrations, obviously downtown area. The blue circles are bus ridership and the orange circles are trolley ridership. So downtown is very heavy. All along the South Line corridor down to San Ysidro, orange ridership, trolley ridership in San Ysidro, and then bus and trolley really going all the way up and then into Old Town and the Mission Valley area. This all blue here, this is the mid-city area, North Park and City Heights going up to SDSU. Then good ridership out in the El Cajon Transit Center, feeding people in and out of the East County communities. And then up here, you see very large circles in the University City community. We had very, very extensive ridership increases around UCSD since they passed the U-Pass program. And that's also, you see some high ridership along the I-15 corridor where we've implemented our Rapid Route 235. So this is weekdays. So to compare Saturdays, Saturdays, you see the system really condenses quite a bit. So Saturday ridership is only about 60% of weekday ridership. And then looking at Sundays, Sundays is even smaller. You see that contract even more. So Sunday is only about 40% of weekday ridership, which is why a few years ago when we had to do budget-related service reductions, we really concentrated those on weekends when our ridership is much, much lower to have a much lower impact on our passengers. So looking at different routes, we really use three primary measurements as key performance indicators for our services. Productivity is our riders per revenue hour is one of them. And these are the routes that perform best in terms of our riders per revenue hour. So we have our Super Loop rapid route up in the UCSD area. We have some Otay Mesa San Ysidro routes, including the one that you approved the expansion of service for today. We have our Route 13, which starts in National City and goes up into Grantville through the mid-city area, and then Route 215 is our rapid mid-city route. And Route 5 provides service along Market Street. So these are our very most highly productive corridors for service. Looking at our routes that have more challenges with productivity, most of these are minibus routes. These are community type shuttles. You see in National City, Coronado, Mission Hills, Point Loma, Mission Valley and Grantville area. And then our Express 870 service between East County and Kearney Mesa. And then the red tails you see going off to the right, those are our rural services. And I'll mention a little bit more about rural services in a bit. One of our other key performance indicators is farebox recovery. So this doesn't actually show the routes itself, but it shows the spread. Each of these lines indicates a route. And the colors indicate the type of service. So the green lines over here are the three trolley lines. The red are our express, rapid, and rapid express routes. And then these purple lines, these are urban frequent and rapid routes that provide a 15-minute service throughout the day. And then our orange routes, these are our urban standards. These are generally 30 to 60-minute frequency. Our circulator routes, these are the ones that you saw the lower productivity. These are usually 30 to 60-minute frequency using minibuses. And then you see on the far right the rural routes. The rural routes are very challenged. A couple of them are actually at less than 5% farebox recovery. So we'll be looking more in depth at those. Looking at the subsidies per passenger, this is the third of our three main key performance indicators for route performance. The trolley subsidy per passengers are very low for all of the lines, and then you see the range for all of the other categories there. And then again on the right, the rural ones, we're actually approaching $50 and $60 on some of those rural routes subsidy per passenger. So they go off the chart. We want to look at the route speed. This is something that we're continually challenged with is traffic and signals and stop signs and everything else grows. You see our routes continuing to slow down. And this is really primarily in the mid-city communities where you see these challenges. See our routes, Route 7, 10 miles an hour, that's our highest ridership route. So this is something that we're going to be looking at as we go through the TOP and we do some analysis to see if there's a way that we can increase the speed of these, because remember that's one of the primary things that passengers identified as a reason that they don't ride service or one of their challenges to using our service. So some key findings of the service analysis. We have 8 routes that perform very well above 40 passengers per revenue hour. And we have 12 routes that we really need to do a little bit more focus on that are operating under 15 passengers per hour. So that's really a resource allocation, how many people we're serving with every hour of service that we're paying to put out on the street. The ridership patterns really have remained similar over the last 10 years, but there are a couple specific markets that have really risen. One is UCSD, again, as they've passed that UPass, and another is Otay Mesa. So we saw that on some of the other maps. We have 6 routes with average weekday speeds under 10 miles an hour, and 4 of these are routes that we're running every 15 minutes, so we're putting a lot of resource into it. Every tenth of a mile per hour that we reduce has a cost associated with it, so that's fewer people that we can serve with the same amount of resource. We have 19 routes that are performing under 80% on time. So this is something that we're also going to look at to see what about that we can address from a planning perspective, if there are routing or bus stop or other things that we can make changes to that will improve that figure. So our implementation strategy as we move into the next phase of the project is really to address both the market and the performance issues while looking at all of the input that we received from the almost 4,000 responses we got to our survey. So with the survey and the market analysis and service analysis wrapping up, we are beginning the service implementation plan this month. Once we have some proposals, we'll be going out to the public for additional outreach, and then we'll begin the scheduling and implementation in spring, and hopefully starting some of the changes in summer. And the other thing that we're having transportation management and design work on is our Designing for Transit manual. This is really our Bible that we use, that we distribute to the community and cities and the developers on how to make communities work for our system. So they're going to be updating that for us. And then we may, as an optional task on this, have them do a feeder bus study for the Midcoast extension as well as the South Bay Rapid projects. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
You know, I think you've probably come to the conclusion I have that this is a wonderful source resource, and I would certainly recommend that each of you save that for your future use. So I want to commend you, Dennis, for doing a great job in putting all this information together. That's certainly a real challenge to put together something like this, and then to have a plan, basically, which will update us and to make sure that we keep abreast of the market that we have. Having said that, any comments from anyone? Yes, Ms. Allison.
Yes, well, I really appreciated the report. I thought it was really good, presented in a manner that was really easy to digest. And I only had one question about the survey distribution. I don't think that the survey distribution or the answers would change any of the analysis of the product, but why was there such a low response rate in the South Bay area when we have such heavy ridership?
Yeah, I think one of the things, and maybe this is the way that I kind of broke it up, we had it by zip code, so I added some of the zip codes together. So, for example, the Chula Vista area, I added everything in Western Chula Vista together and then everything in Eastern Chula Vista. So you actually see that twice in here. See the Otay Ranch, East Lake, and Bonita areas mm-hmm. in this green, and then up here, the Chula Vista West and Central areas in this one. I think this is actually probably pretty representative when you look at the overall percentages in Central San Diego versus South Bay and East County. This is actually probably pretty representative of the percentages of ridership. We don't exactly know the ridership by zip code, but based on boardings, mm-hmm. it actually is a pretty good dispersion, or that's not the right word, but a pretty good representation of where we see our ridership. So. That's a good question. What we did is we did pretty extensive advertising on all of our services, including all the buses and the trolleys. We put the take ones out. We did outreach events at different stations within Chula Vista and National City, and we were at San Ysidro. So we tried to get out there. I think hopefully we got some good answers.
And did you do your outreach in Spanish as well as English?
Yes. Okay. Yes. The survey was actually available in four languages.
Okay, great.
And then at all of our outreach events, we had Spanish and English speaking staff available.
Okay, great. Well, it's a great report. Thank you.
And Mr. Roberts.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dennis, this is fantastic. I mean, this is really the stuff that you need. And it, you know, for people who stand on the fringes just saying we don't need this or we don't need that, this kind of shows you need a lot of this and that. I guess there's a couple things. One of them, in spite of your, at least if I followed your comment, you saw a significant difference between the current housing and employment density compared to the 2050. And the one thing that surprised me was how little the pattern changes between now and 2050 based on your projections. Did I miss something in here?
No, I think that's exactly right. If you blink, you miss the change almost, because it really is, it's really densification of the existing land uses within the existing areas.
But the overall patterns, I mean, you see some growth in jobs, especially in the Otay Mesa East area.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, it almost looks like more of the same. And maybe that because it's a reflection of current plans, which is probably based on more of the same.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, and we're trying to come to grips with this, is we're about to be run right into one of the most disruptive technologies that's ever been introduced. The automated driving is coming much quicker than anybody wants to recognize. And we're trying to deal, you know, it's hard to figure out how this is going to change our patterns, our use, how it's going to affect public transit or any kind of transit. And we're trying to deal with that. I'm trying to arrange for some speakers at our Sandag retreat in the spring that can maybe help give us a better picture of what might be happening. But it's going to affect us in a big way, and it's kind of frightening to think about that and sort of do our planning with that's out there, but we're not quite sure what it's going to do. So it's just a beware. But you know, we just went through something where we had people telling us, you know, we didn't need any new public transit. Clearly we do. We had people telling us we don't need any new roads. Clearly we do. And it's this information, though, I think should really help us to inform us and some of our shorter range planning, shorter range being the 5 to 10 year period, as opposed to the long stuff. The going out to 2050 is almost impossible in today's world with what's coming. But thank you.
Anyone else? Yes, Ms. Cole.
I'm echoing the accolades of everyone else. Excellent. And we're all going to keep this at our desk, I think, forever. Yeah, absolutely. Is there a timeline for addressing something that we could possibly address now, like the time and convenience, which is really high? That's the survey. I mean, it's not convenient enough, and the times are not regular enough, and the service is not. Is there a timeline to address that?
Yeah, I think what we're going to do with the service implementation is over the next 2 months, we're going to come up with some pretty solid proposals and take those out to the communities and see if these proposals actually address what they're talking about. And then from there, depending on the level, minor changes we'd like to start implementing in June. More major changes, we'll be coming back to you with a public hearing and allowing the public to speak to you on those, as well as the Title VI analysis. And then those will be a later implementation, probably September or January 2018. But hopefully we'll be able to start some minor changes in June.
Great. Great survey. Thank you so much.
Mr. Jones.
A lot of these numbers I've seen sitting on planning at Sandag for 14 years now, and some of this is new. It's excellent stuff. Having been on Sandag for quite a while, there were some numbers that I've seen as we projected out there where travel times would go down, which I'm guessing is a lot of people's concern, is the travel times. So I'm curious, you know, how Prop A is going to affect those. As we move those travel times and the reduction in travel times that I've seen in the future, and that'll be interesting to see how that works out. You guys have your work cut out for you.
Yeah, and one of the things we're facing is we're trying to find more money for this, you know, and there's a statewide effort that we're involved with to try to come up with some funding for this kind of thing. As well as, you know, Measure A, we wanted to be at the ready. That's why we kind of accelerated this TOP to get it done in case Measure A came in. And so we are looking at a lot of different ways to try to make some of the changes that the public is asking for. But it's always going to be a, you know, if you give it to here, you may have to take it from there. So that's the challenge.
You know, over the years, I've always, one of my mantras has always been to look at the job centers and how we move people, because we tend to move people and be concerned about how we move people from where they live, and we pay a little bit less attention to where they work and where the jobs are. I don't know how much communication goes. I'm the alternate here, so I don't know how much communication goes on between Sandag and MTS. I suppose you guys are you're kind of at the receiving end of the decisions made there, but just know that there are people that are aware that the job, you know, the jobs and where the job centers and the housing centers are an issue for all of the county. But unfortunately, on cities like San Diego, they were created in like the last 75, 80 years. You know, that ship sailed about 80 years ago when the pattern started. It's not like you'd go in and bulldoze down complete neighborhoods to kind of recreate that. Chula Vista's had the best opportunities to make those changes, you know, in East Chula Vista, probably of any of us, but that's going to be the challenge. I think the only thing we're going to be able to do as we move forward is to densify, do more smart growth, and at best we'll be able to mitigate, you know, where we go from here. So,
and not just the SANDAG planning efforts, but the city's planning efforts too. There's a real movement to try to incorporate, you know, complete streets concepts and that kind of thing. But a lot of times that's the detriment of transit. So Dennis showed you a number of routes that are really suffering, that at their speeds are declining. And that's because a lot of times there are improvements that are made in community planning that are helping the bicyclists or pedestrians or whatever, and yet they're not taking into consideration, well, a bus needs to move quickly through this street. And if we're going to start, you know, piecing off the street or giving it to other things, then that's going to make the bus go slower through that street.
So your challenge there is really getting that message down to the individual cities that, where they make those land use decisions.
And the communities themselves, the communities that want transit, you know, they want to see transit, but they sometimes don't understand the impact that their other decisions are making on transit.
Well, I'm fortunate because I get to sit in a lot of different spots and hear different things, but sometimes I know it's, even in conveying the things that I hear to my colleagues, it's difficult to get them to pay attention or get them to kind of see how all the puzzles pieces fit together. So that's the challenge that you all have is in doing that. So thank you.
I'll take Mr. Wywody, and then Paul wants to make a comment.
When I looked at the chart that you showed, which would be page 13, it doesn't have a number on it, but it's the one before 14, population and employment, it struck me that all of the military bases are yellow, showing a very low jobs per acre. So clearly that's, my first thought is that's wrong. But my guess is that it's a lot of people working, but a whole lot of real estate underneath it, so the denominator is much larger. So it may be more useful, since these are probably the biggest employment centers in the region, to have this broken in finer detail. So if you looked at North Island, for instance, and you looked at 16,000 people trying to get to that place every day, maybe you would get it with the appropriate density if you didn't use the whole base, most of which is not a work center, it's an airfield. Same thing for Spaor, Miramar really stands out, major employment center. It looks like nobody ever goes there. So that's a level of fidelity I think this needs in order to be useful for what I think are arguably the biggest employment centers in the region.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you for pointing that out. And we noted that as well. So these will be adjusted to include the military. This information comes from American Community Survey, so that handles the military a little bit differently, which is why it doesn't show up on here. But absolutely, and TMD will be incorporating that information as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment based on the question of when we might make some of these changes. One of the things that we're going to be doing very early after the first of the year is starting a, for lack of a better word, a budget analysis, especially since Measure A didn't pass, okay? So that means there were a number of capital items as well as things like security, et cetera, that were in Measure A that are not going to happen now. And so there's not going to be a lot of new services added also that were included in Measure A. That on top of when Mike came up and showed you the budget stuff, you know, a lot of our funding sources are not producing what we thought. So I don't mean to cast a wet blanket on things, but I just want you to always keep that in mind, that we're going to have to balance this And I think, you know, something to keep in your minds right now is this is going to be, you know, somewhat of a similar effort to the COA that we did way back in 2005, is that, you know, I think we're going to identify some areas that are very rich targets for us to go after and put more service. And there's going to be services that we're operating that don't do that well. And probably the bigger decision is going to be, do we reallocate to get more bang for the buck and carry more people as a result of those kind of changes? So I just wanted to leave you with that.
Anyone else? Yes, Mr. Alvarez.
Again, thank you. Everybody said the report. Is there a way to get the raw numbers, particularly on the towards the end, you had the bar graphs with the green, red, not bar, they were, I forget what that type of graph is called. No, the one with the, you had trolley, you had the urban lines with a higher frequency.
Oh, sure. Oh, sorry. There.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. That would be helpful because I know each one of those lines represents a different trolley line. Each one of those lines represents a different bus line, and you gave us a little snapshot of which ones perform well for fare recovery, which I assume probably line up with these lines, but if you could, that'd be great.
Sure, and actually all of this information is in our performance monitoring report, so which we didn't present today, but in November.
Okay,
yeah,
so that's all the data you got it from there.
Exactly.
Okay, is that available online?
Yeah, that's on our website.
Okay. And then, so thank you. And then, Paul, to your point, which I think is really important, I would like to see if you, when you prepare that for the board for discussion or for at least for information, what the if we can extrapolate from Measure A what some of the specifics that were funded for transit purposes. And quantify that. And I would like to get a better understanding probably from our legal counsel on what MTS's authority is for potentially pursuing a measure to help fund those services, just to get an understanding on that. Thank you very much.
Anyone else like to comment? If not, I want to thank you, Dennis. It's a great report, I will certainly keep my copy of your slides as a good reference source, and we look forward to hearing more from you as this process continues. Well, that is our final business item from the standpoint of the agenda. Under item 60, Chairman's Report, I just wanted to say that I had the pleasure of presiding over a ceremony yesterday in which we have inaugurated a new, it's the same service, but using a different fuel, and that's the propane. We have the service, the ceremony was out at our facility along SR 52, which you see, it's our access program, and we're transiting, it's run by First Transit under contract us, and we're transitioning to propane-fueled vehicles. And they offer certainly a great deal of advantages over previous vehicles in that propane is a very, very clean fuel. And so that will certainly improve the emission issue. And the other part of it is that they're extremely quiet. And they will, I think, improve the quality of our service. And we have 37 vehicles ready to roll right now. We had a rollout of 10. Just for ceremonial purposes, and we'll ramp up to a total of 77 vehicles. I think, Sharon, when will we have all those 77 in operation?
In January.
Yep. In January. So we're almost there. Did you have anything under comments for the CEOs?
Yeah, and just to add on, I mean, propane is not sexy stuff. I mean, it's been around for a while, and you do a grill, but it really is a huge thing for us because, you know,
we're focused on the environment and we're focused on cost. And these 77 vehicles over their life is going to remove 13 million pounds of greenhouse gases. Okay, it's much better than diesel, it's better than gasoline, and it's going to save us 5.8 million in fuel costs. So it's definitely a win-win, and it's great technology. With that, I traveled twice, November 15th and 17th. I was in Oakland for the California Transit Association annual fall conference, and on December 1st, I was a speaker in Las Vegas at a Transportation Research Advisory Committee. It's kind of a public committee dealing with their transportation future, specifically rail, but all the expenses were paid for by them. And other than that, I wish you very happy holidays.
Under item 62, board member communications, I'd like to begin by noting that Mike Wywody, this is his last meeting with us, if I'm not mistaken, Mike, and we certainly want to thank you for your service to this board. You've been a very faithful and involved member, and it's been a privilege to have you with us, and we certainly wish you well. Thank you. And any other comments or any other board communications? Okay, I don't have any public speakers in front of me, so our next meeting date is in the new year, January 19th, and I join Paul in wishing you all a very happy and a joyous holiday.
In the rare thing where the chairman and the vice chair is not here.